been mostly off the table for many Venezuelans in public places, in social media, in places it can be heard and seen.
The world is focused on Venezuela right now.
What is day-to-day life like inside the country?
We'll talk to a journalist on the ground in Caracas.
For Tuesday, December 9th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A once fringe idea has become more and more mainstream in American politics.
That's the idea of reverse migration.
What it means is ethnically cleansing or forcibly deporting from traditionally white countries everybody who's not white. That's the idea.
And 20% of American adults say their mental health is poor.
Being a caregiver is really taking a drain on people's mental health, financial uncertainty, the state of the world.
We'll take you inside the numbers of a new survey and tell you what they mean.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump heads to Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania today for an event about the economy. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, this comes as Trump faces polls showing voters blaming him for high prices.
Trump has spent very little time during his second term traveling around the country to sell voters on his policies. Now with his approval ratings at a low point and administration officials asking voters for patience, Trump heads to a resort in his swing district in Pennsylvania to talk about the economy. He's called affordability a Democratic con job and a hoax, but yesterday at the White House dialed it back a little.
We brought prices way down from what it was. We inherited high prices.
The most recent numbers show the inflation rate in September was the same as it was during former President Biden's last month in office. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
A federal judge has agreed to release grand jury and other investigative materials from the prosecution of Ghislaine Maxwell, a longtime confidant of the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Ryan Lucas has the latest.
The Justice Department in November asked a federal judge in New York to release the investigative materials from Ghislaine Maxwell's sex trafficking case after Congress passed the Epstein Files Transparency Act. Now, U.S. District Court Judge Paul Engelmayer has granted that request and authorized the department to publicly release the grand jury materials as well as the investigative records while redacting personally identifiable or other victim-related information. A similar request to make public investigative records from Epstein's prosecution in New York is still pending before a different federal judge. Maxwell is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence for sex trafficking and other offenses. Epstein died in a federal lockup in 2019. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Policymakers from the Federal Reserve are holding a two-day meeting in Washington, D.C. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the meeting is expected to wrap up tomorrow with a decision to lower interest rates.
Investors are fairly confident the central bank will lower its benchmark interest rate by a quarter percentage point tomorrow. They'll also be watching what Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and his colleagues have to say about prospects for additional rate cuts in the new year. There's considerable uncertainty as the central bank's trying to keep a lid on both inflation and unemployment. Pepsi is planning to cut jobs and narrow its product lineup by 20% as it works to cut costs and lower prices. The soft drink and snack maker has been under pressure from an activist investor. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
GoFundMe says there was a 20% increase in people using the crowdfunding platform to raise money for essentials like housing and food this year. That follows a quadruple increase in that same category last year. Monthly bills was the second fastest growing category in 2025. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is reaffirming his refusal to give up land as part of a peace deal with Russia. President Trump is pressuring him to accept the U.S. proposal that Ukraine cede territory to Russia, arguing that Moscow has the upper hand in its nearly four-year-old invasion. Employees at the Louvre Museum in Paris say they plan to go on strike next week over pay and working conditions. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports it's the latest in a litany of woes facing the world's most visited museum.
Three unions representing museum staff sent a joint notice to Louvre management announcing the strike. Insufficient staffing, ever-increasing workloads, and the building's aging condition are among the reasons cited by Le Monde and other French media for the walkout. NPR has reached out to the unions to obtain a copy of their notice. notice. The proposed Labour action follows several disasters at the museum this fall, including the theft of crown jewels worth more than $100 million, the sudden closure of a gallery due to weakened beams, and a water leak that damaged hundreds of rare books in the Louvre's Egyptian Antiquities Department. The Louvre did not immediately respond to NPR's request for comments about how it is handling the strike or the months of negative press. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
An officer at a maximum security prison in South Carolina found contraband dropped by a drone, including marijuana, loose tobacco, as well as crab legs, steak, and Old Bay seasoning. The State Department of Corrections wrote on social media that it seems like inmates were planning a holiday crab boil and steak dinner. I'm Rylan Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It's 4:06. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. We have a winter weather advisory in effect now through 3 a.m. for much of the area, 6 a.m. in Bemidji and northwestern Minnesota. 3 to 7 inches of snow possible. Expect slippery road conditions.
News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Tomorrow, Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado will be in Oslo to collect the Nobel Peace Prize. Machado has spent the past year in hiding inside the country she hopes to one day lead. The Nobel Committee noted, quote, serious threats against her life in their announcement that she had won the prize. And all of this has played out as the U.S. military has ramped up its presence near Venezuela to pressure the government and also attacked roughly 24 alleged drug vessels. So the rest of the world is putting a lot of focus on Venezuela right now, and we wanted to get a sense of what the past year has been like inside the country. To do that, we are joined from Caracas by Venezuelan journalist Tony Frangi. He heads the newsletter Venezuela Weekly. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much. It's an honor for me to be here.
Let me just start with the Nobel Prize. How much do you think people in Caracas will be following the presentation tomorrow? We'll be talking and thinking about that.
I think it's a very important topic of conversation here, even though it's not a very public one because of the state of affairs in the country. But many Venezuelans are expecting to see if Maria Corina actually managed to leave Venezuela for Oslo, as she said. I think that's one of the main reasons people are watching and following the news of the prize, but also the fact that these are very big news for us, and many people see them as the result of the struggle and the democratic fight that many Venezuelans have been enduring for the last year in the country after the July 28 elections of 2024.
When you talk about a lot of conversation but not too public about it, give me a sense of what that looks like. Is that just a side conversation? Is that just on your phone but not in public on social media? Like, what's the best way to understand that and why?
So after the elections happened and the opposition managed to prove that their official results were not the ones shown by the polling station machines, the government proceeded with a bigger crackdown on civil society. And since then, politics have been mostly off the table for many Venezuelans in public places, in social media, in places it can be heard and seen. So it has become more or less a conversation within family or within private circles. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's reports of journalists, of radio journalists who were fired from their jobs because they reported of the Nobel Peace Prize.
Really?
So in a way, there's a lot of sense of fear due to repression and a lot of self-censorship in Venezuelans that has forced many of these conversations and topics to more private and intimate spaces.
I want to talk about the election in a moment, but on this topic of what conversation is like and censorship and self-censorship, what is being said or thought and talked about when it comes to all of this U.S. military pressure? Is that front and center, or is that also an on-the-margins conversation?
It's especially on the margins because the government also has a heightened sense of paranoia due to the constant U.S. air incursions and, of course, the warships in the coast. So what we've seen is a mix between people whispering their opinions or what they think and more or less a generalized sense of denial with the situation. For many Venezuelans, the only solution is to keep forward with their lives as it is, especially with rising inflation, especially with a increasingly worse economic situation during the holiday seasons. So sometimes people wouldn't think that a country that is supposedly on the brink of war, you can find, I don't know, Christmas fairs or Halloween parties or new stores opening up and people just going to buy stuff there for Christmas. But it's what's happening, because for many, the only solution is to just keep on with their daily lives and try to act as nothing is happening, because I feel that many Venezuelans won't really consider this to be a bluff until something actually happens. It's been 25 years of constant political upheaval. So for many, it's just, you know, another check in the long list.
Yeah. Do you see any physical signs of preparations for any sort of military conflict?
Not as much. The government has moved certain assets to the cause. They have moved machinery to take down planes to military bases. There has been a mobilization of the militia. But beyond that, the city more or less remains perhaps more militarized, perhaps with more policemen, but more or less life remains the same in Venezuela. At this point, we're having practically weekly incursions of F-18 or B-2 planes from the U.S., and it's just become like another normal thing. We actually had one today, and people are just going on with their lives because it has already become a weekly thing for more than a few months.
You know, NPR has been trying to report from Venezuela, but has not been granted permission to enter the country. What is one thing about life in Venezuela today that you feel like people listening to this should know that you wish you could tell more people about?
Well, I would say, firstly, that if you see a country with baseball stadiums full of people and people doing Christmas shopping, it doesn't mean that that country is not in crisis or that that country is not following politics, but rather that countries with crisis, with political conflicts, even with war, people there, they try to continue their lives as it is. And it's two things that can coexist despite how bizarre it can look. And on the other hand, I would say that people should sometimes give more voice to Venezuelans and listen to Venezuelans. I feel U.S. media has focused itself mostly on foreign analysts on the country. And there hasn't been much space for voices of Venezuelans. And I think that's important, especially because, as I said, many Venezuelans are self-silencing themselves or doing self-censorship. And that is definitely generating a bias in their reporting. So I would say that they should consider that Venezuelans' opinions are more varied and diverse than they think. And definitely many times they will clash with what many in the U.S. think should happen or think is happening in Venezuela.
Well, we were really happy to talk to you about it. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
That is Venezuelan journalist Tony Frangi joining us from Caracas. Thank you.
Raul Malo, the lead vocalist for the band The Mavericks, has died. According to a statement from Malo's family, he died on Monday evening at the age of 60. With a career lasting over four decades, Malo had one of the most recognizable voices in American country and roots music. NPR Music's Felix Contreras says his band The Mavericks challenged expectations, with Malo's voice leading the way.
It was one of the most unlikely stories in American music. Raul Malo, a first-generation American who was the child of Cuban immigrants and who grew up in Miami, became a country music star.
There goes my heart.
The band he formed in 1989 was called The Mavericks, and it lived up to its name. The band blended country, rock and roll, folk music, jump blues, Latin music, and an occasional Cajun beat into its distinct sound.
You told me once we'd never part, and you love me with all your heart.
In 1995, Malo told WHYY's Fresh Air that the inspiration for that musical mashup came from his Cuban immigrant parents.
I grew up in a pretty musical household, so there was all kinds of music around, always. We listened to everything from Hank Williams to Celia Cruz to Sam Cooke to Bobby Darin. It didn't matter.
In an interview with NPR in 1992, Raul Malo explained that the wide-open musical appreciation he experienced at home wasn't exactly appreciated in Cuban Miami, and yet his experiences held some life lessons that would shape his musical destiny.
I guess I was, you know, real different, and I never even realized, and I didn't know why at the time, you know, and it was pretty painful, you know, sometimes, you know, because you kind of felt like, well, you know, you don't really belong. But now that I think about it, you kind of learn to depend on one person, and that's yourself.
That deviating from the norm allowed him and the band to slide between genres, and they eventually found a legion of true believers in their sound. And in addition to following his instincts, it was that voice that set Raul Malo and the Mavericks apart. From heartbreaking ballads,
without a love of my own,
to country-tinged tales of nostalgia and loss,
I wanna go across the river to the house on Lonely Road where my life began and ended all the same,
to full-on western swing barn-burning rave-ups. His voice charmed just about anyone who heard it, and along the way, Malo and the Mavericks collected awards and recognition from the Academy of Country Music, the Country Music Association, a slew of Grammy nominations in the country categories, and eventually the Trailblazer Award from the Americana Music Association. And in 2020, his distinctive rich baritone was finally heard in Spanish on the Mavericks album called appropriately En Español. Malo explained to reporter Julie Height in August of that year that his bilingual childhood in Miami was part of the inspiration for the album.
I'm first generation Cuban American in my family. I was the first child born in the New World. You had to learn English and you had to speak English, and it was part of the curriculum and everybody spoke it. And at home, I spoke Spanish to my abuelita, and that was fine by me.
And when the sun goes down, your memory still hanging round.
Raul Malo's career reminds us that the roots of American music go deep and wide, and yet he didn't feel like he belonged exclusively to one genre.
To qualify the Mavericks as just a country band is probably a bit unfair, not only to the Mavericks, but to country bands. I don't consider myself a country music artist. I just consider myself a singer-songwriter and who every once in a while writes a country song and does the Grand Ole Opry, which I love doing every once in a while.
The fact that a Cuban-American kid from Miami grew up to perform in that cathedral of country music says everything about Raul Malo and the rewards of doing things on his own terms. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
I see your emerald eyes, your ruby lips on mine, remembering all the love.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, it's our daily dose of phonology. Birthday boy John Latimer looks back at this date. There's a winter weather advisory in effect right now, with snow continuing overnight, lows 7 to 15, northwest winds gusting up to 30 miles per hour, 1 to 4 inches for much of the area, up to 7 inches possible in northwestern Minnesota. Tomorrow, slight chance of snow before noon, partly sunny, highs 12 to 16. Winds from the northwest up to 25 miles per hour.
On this date, December 9th, 1948, a young phenologist was born into this world in the hospital in Park Rapids, Minnesota. His mother had to wade through knee-deep snow out to the road to get in the ancient Dodge that my father drove to get to the hospital. And once there, I resisted coming into this world as long as I could and managed to let the 8th of December slide by, and then in the early morning hours of the 9th of December, I relented and was born 8 pounds 10 ounces. As my father would like to say, that's a keeper, put him on the stringer. And I've been here ever since, and, you know, it's been a pretty good trip so far. Happy birthday, Mr. Phenologist.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay, in theaters this Friday. And from Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. After an Afghan national was charged in the ambush of two National Guardsmen last month in Washington, D.C., the U.S. has further restricted immigration from 19 countries. President Trump has also revived a call for, quote, reverse migration, a once fringe idea that has become a mantra for this administration. NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef joins us now to talk about all of this. Hi, Odette.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so where exactly within this administration are you seeing these calls for reverse migration or re-migration, as it's sometimes referred to, right?
Right. So President Trump on Thanksgiving Day posted to social media about how immigration policies have hurt, quote, gains in living conditions for many. And he said only reverse migration can fully cure this situation. But also the State Department's proposed reorganization plan included a new office of remigration. And the Department of Homeland Security has called for remigration on social media posts. One of them, for example, Elsa, with simply the word remigrate.
Okay, so what does remigrate exactly mean?
Well, here's how Heidi Byrick explained it to me. She's with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism.
Basically, what it means is ethnically cleansing or forcibly deporting from traditionally white countries everybody who's not white. That's the idea.
The idea is often attributed to a French novelist who became known as the originator of the Great Replacement conspiracy theory, which is this baseless claim that white Christian Europeans are being systematically replaced by immigrants in an attempt to dilute European or Western cultures. And remigration was the solution he proposed. And the idea was that it would be a kind of organized removal of immigrants and even the children of immigrants. And Elsa, these were fringe ideas earlier this century, but they are now associated with a movement that cuts across Europe, known as the Identitarian Movement, and which has increasingly informed party politics there and here.
Right now. Okay, so talk more about that. Like, how have these ideas become mainstream today?
So the change is largely attributed to an extreme right Austrian political activist named Martin Sellner. He's a former neo-Nazi, and now he heads up an international network called Generation Identity. And he has worked to bring terms like remigration into popular discourse. I spoke to Julia Ebner about this. She heads the Violent Extremism Lab at the University of Oxford, and she has sat in on strategy sessions for identitarian groups. She says they staged events to create uncertainty and fear because then they found that people were more open to their extreme ideas.
The strategy was all about controlled provocation and strategic polarization. So they were launching media stunts in the streets of from Vienna to Berlin to Paris, where they tried to generate as much media attention as they could possibly get from, for example, simulating a terrorist attack in the heart of Vienna or putting a burqa on top of an old statue. So their idea was to really to provoke strategically and step by step to move the Overton window.
The Overton window, Elsa, refers to the range of policy ideas that the public considers acceptable. Remigration for a long time fell outside that window, but that's no longer true.
No longer true. I mean, it is interesting that these ideas are so strongly associated with Europe. Like, how did they take root here in the U.S. then?
So, a personal story. Years ago, I was interviewing someone who was in charge of recruitment in the Midwest for a group called Identity Europa, which at the time was the U.S.-based identitarian group. And I remember asking him, how did he think the U.S. would become a white nation, if not with violence? And he said he thought people would just re-migrate. I think that was the first time I heard the term. And it sounded ridiculous to me. You know, why would millions of people who had put down stakes just willingly uproot?
Yeah.
Well, years later, remigration has been operationalized. We are seeing it with immigration operations in LA, Chicago, Charlotte, New Orleans, and so on. I did some reporting from Chicago about, you know, the disorder, the tear gas, the pepper guns, military-style raids and beatings that occurred in that operation in places that didn't normally see those things. And so it has been clear that the removal of people is violent.
But what are you hearing, Odette, from White House officials when they are being asked why they are using terms that are adopted by white nationalists?
The White House, the Department of Homeland Security, and the State Department all rejected or didn't acknowledge the European extremist roots of this policy idea when I asked them about it. But I think it's important also to add the context of other terms that this administration has been using, you know, talking about Western values, Western civilization, chiding European allies for making themselves vulnerable to civilizational suicide or civilizational erasure. Bayrick says this is language that sits firmly within the rhetoric of the identitarian and broader white nationalist movement.
That is NPR's Odette Youssef. Thank you so much, Odette.
Thank you.
In Hong Kong, authorities are vowing to conduct a transparent investigation into how at least 160 people died in one of the deadliest fires there in decades. But as NPR's Emily Fang reports, authorities are also arresting and detaining people who have called for accountability over the blaze.
After a massive fire burned down 7 of the 8 high-rise buildings in a Hong Kong residential complex, investigators are looking into the substandard plastic netting and styrofoam boards which encase the buildings. One student named Miles Kwan started a petition for an independent inquiry.
He makes very mild demands that even pro-Beijing figures in Hong Kong would agree to.
This is Chris Chang, a longtime Hong Kong journalist who's been covering the tragedy. He notes the student was briefly arrested over the petition. For Hong Kong authorities, he says,
stability is more important than anything.
And over the weekend, Hong Kong's National Security Office summoned foreign journalists to warn them not to smear the state's response to the fire. Chang says all this erodes public trust, including the fact that the Investigations Committee authorities have assembled has no statutory power.
This kind of committee would not have the legal power to summon people, companies, or officials.
Hong Kong police and local media say Beijing's national security law has been used to arrest at least 4 people so far over statements or actions asking for more accountability over the fire. Thomas Kellogg, executive director of the Center for Asian Law at Georgetown University, says the use of the national security law here is likely intentional.
They give the government more or less a blank check on whom they can arrest, how long they can hold them, and even limits on their basic due process rights. So this is a powerful tool to control and even repress criticism.
Operations for Hong Kong Baptist University's student union were also suspended over the weekend after they organized a commemorative bulletin board for fire victims. Historian Rowena He studies Chinese political movements, especially Beijing's crackdown in Tiananmen Square in 1989. And as she watched the fallout from the Hong Kong fire, she says she started to cry at the parallels she saw.
Watching all of this happen in the past 35 years since Tiananmen, you saw that it happened again and again and again, and they're coming after Hong Kong.
Historically, she says, the whistleblowers are always punished. Emily Fang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 4:29. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. We also thank Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Our weather forecast, winter weather advisory currently in effect with 3 to 7 inches of snow possible. Expect slippery road conditions with lows tonight 7 to 15, northwest winds 10 to 15, gusting up to 30. And tomorrow, slight chance of snow before noon, then partly sunny, highs 12 to 16, blustery northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native actress Elaine Miles, known for her roles in TV's Northern Exposure and the 1998 movie Smoke Signals, has spent the last month contending with a run-in with ICE agents and the response to her sharing her story with local and national media. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
On November 3rd, Miles says she was at a bus stop in Redmond, Washington, preparing to do a target run when several men in camo fatigues and tactical gear appeared. For 45 minutes, she says they deliberated over the legitimacy of her tribal ID and if they were aware of her rights as a U.S. citizen.
I go, are you federal? Are you recognized as a federal officer? Do you have the warrant stating that you have right to stop me? And then they kept saying, we don't need a warrant. And I go, yes, you do.
Miles said the man often looked confused at her assertions and finally left when another man called them back to a waiting SUV. In the following weeks, as ICE activity continued around Redmond, Miles retreated from doing things around town, prompting concern from relatives and friends. She decided late last month to share her story, including with the Seattle Times, Newsweek, and Salon. She found support, but also toxic trolling.
People are calling me a racist, a bigot. I'm hateful, you know, and then I even had some people say I was a pretendian. Oh, and I like this one. Miss Piggy, go back to the reservation where you belong.
Miles says she'll keep sharing her story and advises her fellow natives to carry their tribal IDs, passports, and copies of their birth certificates. Meanwhile, Miles is looking forward to her next TV project, a law enforcement pilot that will start filming next year.
Probably be like January, February. She's a knowledgeable cop.
Tribes across the U.S. have reported their citizens being confronted by ICE as President Trump's immigration crackdown continues. On Veterans Day, a Native woman in Des Moines, Iowa, had an ICE detainer placed on her, which almost led to her being put into ICE custody, until it was learned jail administrators confused her with another person with the same last name. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security did not respond to requests for comments. Without reliable internet, it's often challenging for veterans to apply for and access benefits, including mental health care. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, a Phoenix-based telehealth company and a state agency are partnering to help better equip veterans living on reservations.
So far, Janice Tallis Denny, who is Hopi and with the company Televeda, has delivered 16 military-grade kits containing Starlink satellite internet systems at no cost to nearly a dozen Arizona tribes beginning this year in Parker.
If I can do it, anybody can do this.
Her latest stop, New Pasqua, is just on the outskirts of Tucson.
It's a hot day today. We don't want to be out here too long.
Along with her is Dylan Delzato on behalf of the Arizona Department of Veterans Services.
Let's start with 50 of them, see where it goes, and here we are rather quickly. Excited to get the rest of them out there, and a big roadblock for a lot of vets is the internet connectivity.
Especially on tribal lands. Carmen Rivera is the Pascua Yaqui Tribe's Veterans Benefits Counselor and often travels to the Mexico border, meeting with tribal members living off-grid.
And when you give them, you know, information, whether it be off of this system or you give it to them in paper, they like that.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Ye.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more, MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Here on Earth, we take for granted the fact that my watch displays the same time as everybody else's watch does, at least within my time zone. And when you step back and think about it, it is kind of amazing that the whole world can sync up our clocks like that. But it is a lot more complicated to sync up a clock here on Earth with, say, a clock on Mars. And that is because time passes differently depending on where you are in the universe and depending on the gravitational field you're in. Luckily for us, physicists at the National Institute of Standards and Technology have done the math so we don't have to, and they have figured out just how much faster a clock ticks on Mars. Vijayanath Patla is the co-author of a paper all about that out this month in the Astronomical Journal and joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's just get right to it. How much faster do clocks tick on Mars than Earth?
The clocks on Mars, on average, would tick 477 microseconds per day faster than clocks on Earth.
How can I even begin to think of a microsecond?
This is a millionth of a second, and it's approximately the time it takes light to travel 300 meters.
Okay. So why is it? I mean, like, I generally understand the concepts of why time is relative in different places, but why is it exactly that a clock is going to go faster on Mars than Earth?
So the distance from the sun of Mars is way greater than it is on Earth. As you go farther out into the solar system, the gravitational pull of the sun decreases dramatically. And therefore, since Mars is farther out than the Earth, the gravitational pull of the sun is much lesser, and therefore the clocks are going to tick faster.
So I think Einstein's theory of relativity is like a pop culture thing that people at least know the phrase, if not the details, the general idea that gravity affects the passage of time. I'm wondering, do these calculations that you've been working on, do they add anything to that conversation? Is there something new here to think about and learn more about?
This calculation provides a framework where we can test general relativity within the inner solar system, because there is a general consensus within the community that quantum mechanics and general relativity are incompatible. And this kind of clocks on different planets would allow us to put constraints on the limitations of general relativity, or to check whether is there any fundamental connection between quantum mechanics and relativity.
I find this really interesting. I like Mars. I like the general idea of space-time. But is there a practical use for this, or is this one step towards something very practical for the scientific community to have a better sense of now that you figured this out?
The practical aspect comes from, if you want to translate the communication infrastructure that we have on Earth to Mars, then we'll have to have the clock synchronized pretty accurately. Mm-hmm. If you want to have multiple robots and scale up the operation, then the robots have to talk to each other. And therefore, we'll have to have a different way to communicate. And that's where the calculation comes into play. If we are envisioning to becoming an interplanetary species.
That is Bijanet Patla, a theoretical physicist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I know that right now, at least, we're just talking Earth to Earth, but I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Over the past month, close to 10,000 people have been forcefully evicted from a riverside community in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. Now, mass evictions are a recurring story in Africa's most populous city. Advocates say that these homes are being displaced by luxury developments. And as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports, these displacements are often marked by deadly violence.
In Lagos, evictions can mean more than having to leave your home. It can mean watching it crumble, destroyed without notice, like thousands of residents along a stretch of waterfront communities. Bulldozers in Oworonsoke, a community on the edge of the Lagos Lagoon, crushed thousands of concrete structures and shanties, many which had been there for decades. And despairing residents watch on, powerless to stop it.
It's just like a dream. I wish it's a dream.
Esther Lawal is a 44-year-old mother of three, standing in the rubble of her demolished home with her 8-year-old son.
This is my kitchen. I'll cook here every day for my children.
For 11 years, she and her family lived in a 3-bedroom flat she built with her late husband.
What I worked for years, me and my husband, they use a minute to destroy all those things.
All her savings went into building the home, which was destroyed in just minutes, she says. Nearby, 66-year-old Kunle Ogunbowale is bereft. He wanders around in circles around the ruins of his home, wailing and crying out to anyone who will listen. I'm elderly, he says in Yoruba. What work can I do now to survive? They are slowly killing us. Even by the violent standards of mass demolitions in Nigeria, the evictions in Oworonsoke have been brutal. Desperate residents search through smoldering heaps of charred furniture and clothes, slowly moving through a fog of smoke.
They put fire, they burn everything.
One of them, simply called Blessing, speaks in Pidgin and tells me moments ago, police officers came and torched what was left of the site. They even burnt the belongings she'd salvaged and kept in a heap near her home. More than 10 residents have died in the demolitions, according to community leaders. Some were unable to leave their homes before they were crushed. At least one died of a suspected heart attack. The residents blame the Lagos state government and a local traditional ruler, Oba Salu Babatunde, who they say is keen to develop luxury apartments. This week, dozens of residents held a protest outside the state government office in Lagos.
They did everything they were supposed to do, and what is happening is that they're being chased out.
Megan Chapman founded the Justice and Empowerment Initiative, an NGO supporting evicted communities. They helped the community take the government to the Lagos High Court and won an injunction stopping any evictions until the residents were consulted and rehoused. But the injunction was ignored.
They were supposed to be consulted with and resettled before any demolition should happen. But what we're seeing in this country, unfortunately, is that the rule of law is not being respected.
The government has said compensation claims in Oworonsoke are being processed, with residents paid only about $150. But the community claim none of them have received any money. Millions across Lagos worry they will face a similar fate. Up to 75% of the city's 20 million people live in informal housing, according to the World Bank. And some have nowhere else to go. Dozens of worshippers sing at the demolished site of the Christ Glory Church. The walls and roof have crumbled, but for now, a small congregation has remained, holding a service surrounded by rubble. They are one of several communities who were rooted here, but who must now contemplate what comes next. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXC. It is 4:44. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, North Star Stories produced by Ampers, stories from throughout Minnesota. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, offering opportunities in the tap room all season long for holiday shopping and gathering. More about events, pop-up shops, beer releases, and more on Facebook. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Winter weather advisory is currently in effect. 3 to 7 inches of snow possible overnight. Expect slippery road conditions with lows tonight 7 to 15, northwest winds up to 30 miles per hour. Slight chance of snow before noon tomorrow, partly sunny, highs 12 to 16. Northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. Lows tomorrow night 0 to 4 below, and looking ahead to Thursday, mostly cloudy, highs in the mid-teens. 7 o'clock tonight, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River, great mix of music.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, a $4 billion rural data center is proposed in southwest Minnesota. Then, an emergency landing has some asking about tribal sovereignty. And Minnesota rolls out a new DWI sticker system. I'm Gracie J. Geronimo Power, a company with headquarters south of Minneapolis, is pitching a massive new data center project in the southwest part of the state. Geronimo and Nobles Cooperative Electric claim they aim to be transparent and environmentally responsible, arguing that the project could deliver a once-in-a-generation economic boost. Opponents of the project object to turning more farmland into energy installations. The company still needs a tech giant to commit to purchasing the campus and its renewable power. In today's main story, a small plane's emergency landing in Red Lake is raising questions about the sovereignty of airspace over tribal land. Producer Chaz Wagner talks with the pilot and representatives from Red Lake about the controversy.
Yeah, I was flying directly from Roseau to Bemidji. It was a beautiful Wednesday morning.
Earlier this fall, pilot Darren Smedsmo was flying 4,000 feet above Lower Red Lake when he experienced catastrophic engine failure. Darren quickly prepared his 1945 Stinson for an emergency landing on the closest road near the western boundary of the reservation.
A neighbor of mine, absolute coincidence, was right behind me, saw the whole thing. He works for the Department of Transportation. He had radio, he had strobes, he had a slow stop sign. So he stopped traffic and called the tribal police.
The Red Lake Tribal Police were the first to arrive on scene, quickly seizing the plane, citing a 1978 resolution prohibiting the flying of airplanes at a low altitude, less than 20,000 feet over Red Lake tribal lands. Darren says he was unaware of any airline jurisdictions over reservation territories.
Nobody's heard anything about it. The flight school that I was on my way to had heard nothing about it, and they train over that land. So I had filed a flight plan that day. It was actually the first flight plan I had filed in over 30 years.
The Red Lake Tribal Government released a series of statements following the incident stating the plane had not been authorized to land on the reservation and the landing created immediate safety, liability, and resource protection concerns for the tribe.
Red Lake is a little bit separate from the other tribes, where Red Lake did not join the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, and we stand a little more alone.
That's Rebecca Tweeden, a U.S. Army veteran and member of the Red Lake Band of Ojibwe.
Red Lake maintained its own hunting and fishing rights, and it is a little bit separate from the other tribes because the other Chippewa or Ojibwe tribes, they joined the Minnesota Chippewa tribe and have kind of a, like a unity where they can challenge anything that comes up to them.
Six of the seven Minnesota reservations were allotted at the time of the passage of the 1887 General Allotment Act. Red Lake Reservation was never allotted, and the land continues to be held in common by all tribal members. The Treaty of Old Crossing in 1863 officially recognized Red Lake as a separate and distinct tribe. Smedsmo says he's grateful for how Red Lake tribal authorities treated him.
The police department director was wonderful to me. The tow truck lady, she hugged me and and she hugged my wife. And the prosecutor, he was very respectful.
A trial hearing was scheduled for November 3rd, but was postponed. A new date is yet to be announced. Red Lake Nation Legal Department did not respond to North Star Stories' request for comment. For North Star Stories, I'm Chaz Wagner.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Minnesota is replacing special license plates with permanent stickers to identify vehicles stopped for driving while impaired, or DWI. Officers will now place the invalidation sticker directly over the license plate, which will also be canceled in the state databases. Police say the new system is faster and safer, and consequences for drivers remain the same. Lawmakers say the changes reduce risks for officers and eliminate the need to store and destroy thousands of seized plates.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Breast cancer among men is rare but real. Now the Veterans Administration is making it harder for male veterans with breast cancer to get care and disability benefits. The agency says the Biden administration improperly classified men's breasts as reproductive organs, but critics say cancer patients are getting caught up in the Trump administration's war on gender ideology. WUNC's Jay Price reports.
Breast cancer was among several illnesses the VA had considered presumptive under the PACT Act of 2022. That law had made it easier for veterans who got sick after exposure to burn pit smoke or other toxins to get benefits, because certain illnesses were automatically presumed to be connected to military service. The law allows the VA to add illnesses to the list as new data emerges, and under President Biden, the VA had added male breast cancer under reproductive cancers, the same category that female breast cancer fell under. But now the VA has removed it. The policy change, which was first reported by ProPublica, went into effect September 30th and requires male veterans with breast cancer to not only document that they were exposed to toxins, but also to prove that those toxins caused the disease. The change applies only to men, not women.
That's a real head-scratcher.
Terry Ballinger, a veteran of the first Gulf War, was diagnosed with breast cancer last year.
I mean, everybody in oncology is highly confident that male breast cancer and female breast cancer are virtually identical. They're identical in the way that they're diagnosed and the way that they're treated.
Ballinger filed his disability claim when male breast cancer was still considered presumptive. Even so, he needed a lawyer to get the VA to approve it. Ballinger says he was exposed to a wide range of toxins in the Army, including asbestos, depleted uranium, burn pit smoke, and the choking clouds from burning oil wells. With no family history or known genetic predisposition to breast cancer, he says his service-related exposures are the most obvious culprit.
I don't want to say it has to be, but all, you know, if you start eliminating possibilities, you end up coming back to that.
In a written statement, a VA spokesman said the Biden administration had, quote, falsely classified male breast cancer when the VA put it under illnesses of the reproductive system. Critics, including several Democratic members of Congress, say the change stems from President Trump's executive order that bans gender ideology in the federal government. That order says policies must treat men and women as biologically different. The members of Congress wrote a letter to the VA saying the policy change distorts science for politics. Dr. Ben Park is a leading breast cancer researcher.
So the vast majority of male breast cancer biologically is in fact reflective of the most common type of breast cancer in women.
He said it's irrational to use semantics about gender to treat male and female breast cancer patients differently.
That would be like, let's not treat colon cancer in men, but we'll treat it in women. That doesn't make sense to me.
Male breast cancer accounts for fewer than 1% of all cases of breast cancer, but studies suggest it's more common and more lethal among veterans. The VA says it diagnoses about 100 cases a year. Activist Mike Partain helped lobby, successfully, to make sure the PACT Act included benefits for people exposed to toxic water at Camp Lejeune. He was born on the base while his father was a Marine there and later developed breast cancer. Partain called the the policy change disturbing and said it worsens what he regards as a serious flaw in the law, that it already didn't list breast cancer as presumptive for toxic exposures occurring in the United States, including at Lejeune.
We were seeing so many men with breast cancer popping up at Camp Lejeune. When I was tracking it, I had gotten over about 125 men that had the single commonality of male breast cancer and exposure to the contaminated water.
He says if an illness like male breast cancer isn't considered presumptive for military-related exposures, the odds that the VA will approve a claim for it are low. In its statement, the VA said it will continue to provide care and benefits for male breast cancer patients who already receive them, as well as for new claimants who can prove a service connection. The Democratic members of Congress are asking the VA to reverse the new policy and be more transparent about benefits changes. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Durham, North Carolina.
The latest poll by the National Alliance for Mental Illness finds that 1 in 5 American adults rate their mental health as poor, and a majority of them are opposed to cuts to federal jobs and to federal funding for programs addressing mental health, substance use, and suicide prevention. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports.
The NAMI Ipsos poll asked more than 2,000 adults across the country about their own mental health, as well as the state of mental health care in the country. Hannah Weslowski is chief advocacy officer at NAMI.
If you think about it, 1 in 5 saying their mental health is poor right now is deeply concerning.
She says respondents identified a range of factors affecting their well-being.
Being a caregiver is really taking a drain on people's mental health, financial uncertainty, the state of the world. So all of these things are really taking a toll.
The poll also asked respondents about their thoughts on whether lawmakers are doing enough to address mental health needs in the country.
Nearly 2 in 3 Americans say that they don't think Congress is doing enough about mental health. They also say they're dedicating too little resources to mental health care.
She points out the cuts to the country's main federal mental health agency, which has lost nearly half of its 900 employees this year due to the Trump administration's efforts to cut federal spending. But nearly 3/4 of poll respondents are opposed to such cuts to federal staffing and programs for mental health, substance use, and suicide prevention, like the 988 Lifeline.
It is hard to find an issue where Americans agree strongly, but we see again and again in these polls that Americans think that mental health, suicide prevention, 988 should be among the highest priorities for Congress in terms of dedicating federal funding.
The poll's results aren't surprising, says psychologist Benjamin Miller.
What we saw in those data from the survey is what a lot of people have been saying for years.
Miller, an adjunct at Stanford University, wasn't involved in the new poll. He says people in communities across the country have been struggling to access mental health care for themselves and their loved ones.
It's frustrating, it's expensive, and it's often not what you want when you want it. So people see this brokenness, and they don't believe that our leaders are seriously thinking about fixing it.
He says the cuts to Medicaid passed in President Trump's budget bill and higher health insurance costs will only worsen access to care for mental health and substance use. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states, Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7 o'clock, John Hanningsgaard, your volunteer host for a great mix of music on the river. Winter weather advisory is currently in effect with 3 to 7 inches of snow possible. With lows tonight, 7 to 15, northwest winds up to 30 miles per hour, and for tomorrow,